Hey, I'm Bob Runkle, and for as long as I can remember, I've loved pop culture. Despite the challenges I've faced in my life, pop culture has always been there for me. I love talking to people and being a platform for others to share their thoughts, stories. Because if there's one thing I never get tired of, it's seeing driven, talented, and inspiring individuals follow their dreams, no matter what obstacles are in their way. And I know a thing or two about that. Welcome to the DJ Bob Show. I'm DJ Bob. Roll it. So this episode of the pod is a very special one. I'm joined by my friend Jane. Say hello.
Hi.
And we just wrapped up a pretty great experience, wouldn't you say?
So yeah, it was great. We interviewed Stephen Russell, who you may know from games like Fallout or Skyrim or even Starfield. So it was a really interesting interview. We talked about, you know, his career, but of course, we also talked about other aspects of his life that, you know, I didn't even know about. And it's a really, just a really nice interview with a really interesting person. So,
yeah, it was very, I didn't know what to expect from it. And I was pleasantly surprised. I love the dynamic between all of us. I thought it's a nice listen. And I hope you guys enjoy it too. And Jane, how do you think you did?
You know, I think I did all right, considering that I've never interviewed anybody before. I think it went, you know, way better than I thought it was going to go. I was really nervous, but it turned out all right. So I'm really happy that, you know, I did it.
So without further ado, let's get into it. So great to finally connect with you.
Thank you so much, Bob. I'm delighted to make your acquaintance virtually and looking forward to talking today.
And my friend Jane is also here, kind of guest co-hosting along. So she's here too.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Just fine, thanks.
Awesome.
Yeah, so this podcast is very conversational. So if you have any questions for us, like, feel free to ask. It's a very give and take kind of deal. It's not like, I'm going to talk to you about yourself and going to be like, but,
sounds good.
For those that don't know who you are, could you kind of give a little bit of an elevator pitch of who you are and what you've done over the years?
Well, I think for the purposes of this, this conversation, I would say that I'm primarily known as a voice actor for games, going back to the 1990s with the Thief series and continuing until current days with things like Fallout and Starfield and Blood West, most recently. So, I mean, that's part of what I've done. Of course, I'm just going to leave it at that, Bob.
we'll delve in deeper as we go along here. But that kind of leads me to my first initial question. There are common misconceptions about voiceover, as in the sense of people like, oh, I can do voiceover because I can do silly voices or these types of voices. What do you think are the most common misconceptions in your field?
Well, I think you've identified that pretty accurately. It's sort of one thing to be able to, imitate Bugs Bunny or you know, a movie actor or something like that. I think what becomes challenging, particularly in voice acting, is just the ability to sustain a character. The voice is only one aspect of what you're doing, and it really is an acting job primarily, and you have to have those chops and be, you know, experienced in how to create a character, often from very little information or very slight information anyway, and be able to fully inhabit and realize that character, and then sustain it, not just over a single recording session, but often you're looking at recording sessions that go on for multiple years, and you might not revisit that character again until you're called for another session 6 months later. So the ability to recall that character and to be familiar enough with the character's world, their point of view, their inner sense of being, their morality, that's kind of it's not just about having a good voice, and I you know, the voice is important, but it's also I would say it's only about 20% of what's
how to use that voice, how to make sure it can shift and change at a moment's notice too.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what I wonder, in light of this, you know, you talk about voice acting, right? When you go in to record a character, like, say, you know, Codsworth or Nick Valentine, are you in the studio? Are you by yourself, or are you with other characters? Do you just voice everything by yourself, or how does that work?
Oh, no, I'm always by myself. I don't think I have ever done a session with another actor in the same room in all the years I've been doing this.
Wow.
So, you know, I've got people on the line, and I have to my home is on the East Coast, and most of the production for this sort of thing happens on the West Coast. So I'm often in a studio situation where it's just me and the engineer and three or four or five or six other people on phone lines, directing, commenting, throwing in their two cents.
Right.
And so that's another particularly interesting challenge about this kind of work.
Yeah, it must make it really difficult sometimes, I would imagine, because, you know, you're in, I think back to my time playing Fallout, you know, there's all these emotional different conversations, but in reality, you know, it's just you basically talking to yourself. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and a good director will feed you those lines that you're responding to. And I've been lucky to work with some really wonderful directors over the years who have helped guide the process and fill in the blanks when I'm not quite clear about the intention of a line.
So one of the questions that I'm sure you get asked is, what's your favorite project you worked on? And I'm not going to ask you that because you've heard that ad nauseum. What I am going to ask you is, at what point in your career and what project did you realize, wow, what I'm doing here is impactful?
What a great question. Boy, I have to think for a minute about that. I think that, you know, the first game that I ever worked on was the first Thief game, and I was fortunate to get cast in the role of the protagonist in that game. And I was just excited to get the work initially. And then the game came out, and I started to see comments online and And I think really it began when we started working on the second installment in the series, Thief 2, The Metal Age. And I started hearing from the people I was working with at Looking Glass Studios about the reaction that the first game had received, the fan response, and clearly that there was enough interest in the game to warrant a second installment seemed really exciting to me. So, you know, and at the time I was doing lots of other things as well. A lot of theater work. I was directing and writing and doing sound design for theater, as well as acting. So this was kind of, and a theater project, particularly in the realm that I was working in, which was fairly localized. You know, you're lucky to be playing to 200 to 300 people a night. You might do an entire show and never see an audience, a total audience of more than 1,000 people. And to suddenly get this exposure that, you know, I was hearing from people all over the world about the game and my work in it and my contributions to it and just the whole. There was a delight in that particular game. I think about the atmosphere and the sound in particular was notable in that game. So that was kind of astonishing in itself to realize that this little project that I had, you know, gotten in my car and driven to Cambridge and stood in a room that was basically a utility closet and made funny voices for a few hours had this impact that it was quite astonishing and gratifying.
So have you ever gotten the chance to like sit down and actually play the games that you've done voice work for, or do you try to avoid doing that?
I have never played through an entire game, I have to admit. And in part, that's because I don't have the equipment. I've never owned a gaming system. And I'm kind of a Luddite when it comes to technology. You're fortunate that our connection actually worked today. But I do have, had opportunities to watch things online, you know, cut scenes and so forth. And my kids have played games, and I would occasionally say, could we try doing this, and I just want to see what it sounds like. And so I the work for me, the pleasure in the work is all in the work itself. I don't get to see much of the finished result. I was delighted recently when my daughter brought her gaming system to our house, and we got to play a little bit of Starfield, and just blown away by the look of the thing. And you know, I got so involved in it, I kind of forgot the reason why I wanted to see it, which was to, you know, see some of the work that I'd done or hear some of the work that I'd done in context. And I was actually surprised when something came along. Oh, there I am, you know. So it's interesting. My connection to the work it pretty much begins and ends in the studio, which is not to say I don't appreciate the work itself. It's just not something that I do have a lot of opportunity to experience.
And that might help you a lot too, because you're not like, when you're wrapped, you're like, you're not like, oh, I wonder how this is gonna look. No, you're genuinely surprised when you do see something, and it's got to be really rewarding for you just to see it in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And there have been occasions when I've seen things afterwards and gone, oh, if I had known that that's what that character was going to look like or move like, I might have made different choices, but sometimes the juxtaposition of the voice that I did create with an image that doesn't necessarily match what was in my head makes for a more interesting, more layered kind of character, I think.
So I don't know what your opinion is going to be on this, but I kind of want to throw it at you and see where we end up. So
okay.
a year or two ago, I was told by an industry professional that I couldn't have a career in voiceover because I was disabled and I would be difficult to understand. I still can't believe somebody told me that. So where do you see diversity and inclusion within the voiceover world?
I'm kind of surprised that you got that response too, because I think that there is opportunity for all kinds of different voices in this field. And the fact that you don't talk like I think at one time we all had this image in our minds that a radio announcer had to sound exactly like this.
Yes, yes.
And the field has gotten so much broader now and so much more welcoming and inclusive that I kind of feel like your opportunities are expanding rather than contracting. I wouldn't agree with that statement that you were told.
I mean, they literally said to me in specific, they said, people don't want to take the time to listen to every nuance of your voice and try to figure out what you're saying. It needs to be right there in their faces, and that's it. But it's like, if people really care, they will take the time to listen and they will take the time to learn.
Yep, I think so too. And if you're convincing in the role, I mean, if we're talking about a traditional kind of voice acting job, then that's the important part.
And, you know, Jane and I both have different degrees of cerebral palsy and other stuff. I mean, how do you feel about that, Jane? Because I'm sure you've had friends of yours. Yeah.
Yeah. I would argue, I'm not in the field, right? But I would argue, if anything, I think voice acting is probably the more accessible, you know, acting industry, because it doesn't matter, like when you're in a studio, you know, it doesn't matter if you look different physically or like you move differently. What matters is, can you, you know, do this voice and like be this character? Like, they don't care like what you look like, you know? So I would argue it's more accessible. So I'm also really surprised that somebody said that to you. That's disappointing.
Yeah, indeed. And it's actually one of the things that I love about voice acting. If I forgot to shave that morning, I can still go into the studio and it doesn't matter.
So how did COVID change your workflow day to day? Do you have a home studio?
I'm not much of a tech person, and I don't have a home studio per se. I have a good microphone and enough equipment that I can do auditions from my home, but I don't claim to have my biggest problem at home is that it's just the kind of noisy environment. We have an old furnace that clinks and clanks and the wind always seems to be blowing through every chink in the house, and there's a pump in the basement that goes at odd times. And we live in a house that was built in 1830, so it's got its own kind of creaks and things like that. And I just kind of enjoy going into a proper studio anyway and feeling like I'm going to work, not going into my bedroom. So that's kind of fun for me. But getting back to your question, COVID definitely put a stop to a lot of this sort of work for me. It was an interesting time in my life for a number of reasons, one of which was that my son and his partner lived with us again for about 6 months from the fall of 2020 into the spring of 2021. And they're both grown adults and had gone off into the world and had lives of their own, but the pandemic coincided with a move that they had been planning to make anyway, and they decided to delay moving to their eventual destination to wait out the pandemic as much as possible by coming home and staying with us, which was really lovely. I did not anticipate that there would be a time when I'd have my adult son and his partner, who we love very much, staying with us. And my son is a sound person. I put the emphasis on the wrong word there, didn't I? He's a sound person. He's a sound person as well. His work right now is as a mixer and dialogue editor for post-production sound in films. And so it was really fun to have them with us. He also loves to cook, which was great, because often he'd be trying out new dishes on us. And it was a delightful time in my life. And I say that fully acknowledging that for many people it was the polar opposite of a delightful time, but I was fortunate to be able to have that experience. And and I have other work that I was able to sustain during that time, so it was in some ways it was a very good time for me.
You know, it's very interesting you say that, because you know, I've been doing this podcast for almost 14 years now, and COVID really helped us in a way, because people were home and it was easier for me to book guests. But I feel like even after, it made people realize the power of using mediums like Skype or Zoom to get work done.
Absolutely. I'd never even heard of Zoom prior to the pandemic.
I don't think I had either. I'm not sure.
I don't think Zoom was actually all that popular. And then the pandemic hit and everybody was like, okay, get on Zoom for work or school or whatever. And now it's like, you know, everybody uses Zoom for everything. I mean, I do, you know, I go to therapy on Zoom. Like it's a thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that happened during the pandemic is that my nephew started a weekly family Zoom call to check in with various family members. And my family, we're close emotionally, but very distant geographically. I have a cousin who lives in Australia, and we have people on the West Coast, East Coast, and everywhere in between in the United States. And we're still doing it, actually. We still, not everybody tunes in every week, but we still have our weekly Zoom calls, and it's just great to catch up with people. And I feel like I've gotten to know folks in my family much better than I ever did before.
For sure. And I think this advent of technology, it almost forced people to exercise creative muscles that they hadn't before.
Well said. Bob, did you find too that you said you've been doing this for 13 years. Did your listenership increase during the pandemic as well?
Yes. And it sounds really trivial, but it made people take the podcast a little more seriously in a way.
Uh-huh.
Because one of the things that happened in the pandemic was that a lot of, they were either doing two things. They were baking banana bread or they were starting a podcast. The problem with so many podcasts is that you got to cut through the noise a little bit more.
Yeah.
Sure.
You got to have whatever your thing is, you know, you got to have your thing. And I think with, you know, people start podcasts, but a lot of people, they don't know what their thing is quite. So they're like, okay, what am I doing? And then, you know, a lot of podcasts, they just kind of fall off the radar because the person doesn't quite, you know, they just don't quite get listenership for whatever reason. But you've done, you know, Bob, you've done really well for yourself, which is amazing. Like it's really cool to see.
And you've almost been here, I think, pretty much the beginning, Jane. Okay, how long have we known each other?
God, really long time. How long has it been? I don't know. It's been a really long time.
Probably like 11, 12 years, something like
that. Yeah. Wow. Gosh, I feel old.
we've watched each other, you know, graduate high school and graduate.
Yeah.
College and do
yep
and be part of each other's lives. So people give the internet sometimes a bad reputation, but sometimes it establishes connections, like either the one Jane or I have, or the one we're establishing with you right now, Steven. It's great.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, it's a tool, isn't it? And all tools can be used in good ways and bad ways. And so it's great that this has become a way that connects people too.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing because, I mean, I don't know, you know, I feel like a number of years ago, people didn't even know what, you know, podcasts were really. And then all of a sudden they got super popular. Now it's like they're everywhere. You know, everybody has a podcast. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yep.
So if you had to choose between living in, you know, the Skyrim universe or the Fallout universe, which one would you pick? I'm just curious.
Are you kidding me? Who would want to actually live in the Fallout universe?
Right.
I think the Skyrim universe is much more.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Because at least you don't have to worry about, you know, nuclear radiation.
Yeah. I could find my little corner where I could just hang out and you know, talk to my cat and have a nice day like that.
Prior to this interview, I was only familiar with Skyrim. So I started watching Fallout stuff and I'm like, yeah, I couldn't end up here.
No, I would be completely just lost because I use a wheelchair. So it's like, what are you supposed to do in a post-apocalyptic environment if you have no mobility? And that's probably like a whole, you know, that could be a whole video game right there. But, you know, it's just, I think about that sometimes and I'm like, man, what would I even do if like the world ended tomorrow? You know, it's like, ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a nice place to visit, but impossible to live there, huh?
For sure.
Yeah.
So I don't mean to be deep and philosophical, but I'm going to be deep and philosophical.
Oh boy.
So what is the most challenging part for you about being a creative person? And on the flip side, what is the most rewarding part for you?
Well, I think that the most challenging part of it has been the economic aspect. I suspect you'd get that same answer from a lot of creative people about trying to balance your time creatively with the need to sustain life and keep a family together and, you know, keep a roof over your head and all that sort of thing. And I think I've been relatively fortunate in that, my wife had a good job and a steady job that allowed us to, allowed me to live a life that had as many variables as a creative life does and ride the waves of a good month versus three bad months and that sort of thing. And I've also, I think, been fortunate to a certain extent in that I've never been entirely dependent upon my creative life for my income. It's always been just one aspect of my work life. And kind of a fluke that it even happened at all. I was my only training per se is I have a master's in library science, and I started out in life to be a children's librarian, and then we made a move at one point in the early 1980s, and there were just no other jobs in that field open in the area at that time. And so I had to kind of figure out what else to do. Having also had this background of playing music and in high school really enjoying acting and, you know, high school drama productions things like that. And I was lucky enough to land in a place where those opportunities were allowed to flourish a little bit, and where those creative alleyways were allowed to open up a little bit more and become roads and then boulevards into bigger things. And I kept trying to see, okay, I've done this now. What happens if I go a little bit further? What happens if I do this? And I kept kind of pushing the boundaries and, oh, that's interesting. Somebody wants to hire me to do this. But at the same time, there was always something else in the background to sustain an income stream. So that's a long-winded way of saying it's been hard to make a living as an actor or as a creative person. But the positive side of it has been just how rewarding I've found the work and the for theater work in particular, there was a social aspect about it that was really wonderful, getting to work with a lot of interesting people and with voice acting too. Even though usually just one guy standing in a little room by myself, I've had an opportunity to work with some incredibly talented people over the years. I mean, people who are just far, far smarter than I am and be the beneficiary of their enormous creativity. And I'm talking about people like Eric Brocious at Looking Glass and Kamal Amarasingham there, Mark Lampert at Bethesda, some of the directors I've worked with, Wes Gleason, Kalel Bogdanovo, Emil Pagliarulo, and some of these people I've never actually met in person. I've just enjoyed working so much on projects with them that I feel my life has been incredibly enriched by their work.
If you have good people around you, like even if it's just by voice, you're all working towards the same goal, and that's to create something, hopefully, that'll impact someone.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. And what I think is really interesting about your career in particular is, you know, you tend to keep taking these roles that are in these Bethesda games? Is it just like, you know, now they know who you are, so they keep inviting you back? Or like, do they still make you audition, or how does that work? Because I feel like at this point, you know, if I worked for them, I'd be like, oh yeah, we know that guy, you know, hire him again. He doesn't need to audition. This is his audition. Like, he's done the work. Let's go.
Yeah. That's not too far from the truth, Jane. I'm lucky in that Bethesda kind of has appreciated the work that I've done for them, and they'll call me now when other opportunities arise. And every now and again, they'll say, "We're not sure you're exactly right for this character. Could you send us some samples?" And but I can't remember a time when I've sent them something and they've said, yeah, no, we're going to get somebody else for this.
I would imagine they'd want you because, you know, I mean, for me personally, right, at this point, you're kind of, for me, a household name of sorts because, you know, I've played so much Fallout. And every time I hear, like, you know, Mr. Handy start talking, I'm like, oh, that's the same person as Codsworth and Nick Valentine. He's everywhere. But, you know, you don't think about that in the moment. But sometimes I think about that after I finish playing. I'm like, how does this voice actor voice all these different people? It's so cool. Like, so, yeah, for me, it would be a no-brainer. Like, if I was their casting director, I'd be like, yeah, I know that guy. He's cool. Let's, you know, bring him on. But, yeah, but I'm not in the field, so.
Thank you, Jane. I wish you were.
You know, I'm going to be honest. I wish I was too, because my thing, and this is my like pie in the sky dream, right? But I want to, you know, one day either write like help write a script for a Fallout game, or be like play a character in one. So I think that'd be really fun. I don't know if it's ever going to happen, but you know, you got to keep dreaming, right?
You got to manifest it.
Yeah. And the Fallout world just seems to keep rolling along. So, yeah. It's not an impossibility.
Yeah, it would be really cool. I can imagine. Like, God, I'm thinking about it, and I'm like, wow, you know, what if I ended up working alongside you? That'd be so weird. Like, 10 years later, it's like, oh, hey, I remember you. What's up? You know,
it's interesting. When we were writing the initial email to you, James just basically threw out names and was telling me people that, you know, she thought would be interesting, and I did too. And I told her, like, wait, that could actually happen. That's doable. And you were like, it is?
Yeah, I was very surprised. I think I sometimes with people, because I get so attached to these characters, I think of you guys as, you know, being larger than life. But it's like, you're really not, you know, you're just people. And I'm sitting here like, oh, okay, this is cool. This is like having a conversation with like my cool uncle or something. You know, it's like, it's not really weird at all. It's like, okay, neat. So,
oh, I might be your weird uncle too, Jane.
Oh yeah, well, that too. But you know, it works. I mean, you have all these. I'm sure you have some crazy stories that, you know, you can like whip out at a dinner party. Be like, you know, this one time I was in the studio and, you know, this thing happened or whatever. So, what's your like craziest story from your time as a voice actor? What's the coolest or most off the wall experience you've had?
Wow, that's a tough one. I think the coolest experience was going to E3 the year that Fallout 4 was about to be released. And they had built a life-size Mr. Handy. And they had invited me to E3 in order to voice this thing so that people could come up to the Bethesda booth and talk to Mr. Handy, and I could see them, and I had a microphone behind this wall and I could talk to them as Mr. Handy, and it was really fun, and I got to meet from behind the wall anyway some really interesting people that day. Linda Carter, aka Wonder Woman, being one of them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The thing that they had forgotten to do was include some way so that I could hear what the people I was talking to were saying. So I had to kind of guess at what they might be saying to me.
Oh no.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I was 100% accurate all the time.
Well, you tried. That's what matters. You know, and yeah. I'm sure, I mean, speaking as a Fallout fan, right? I would have been like, oh my gosh, I get to talk to Mr. Handy. It's so cool. Like, I wouldn't have cared what you said. I would have been like, yes, you know, Codsworth is here. He's alive, you know. So, but didn't Linda Carter, she did, I can't remember. I think she did some of the music for Fallout as well. Like on the radio, wasn't she? I think she was doing some of the songs. I seem to remember like she did a couple of original songs. She was like the singer lady in one of the cities or something. But yeah, that's really interesting.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah. And her husband, Bob Altman, was the head of the parent company for Bethesda for many years.
We gotta love that synergy.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, you got worlds colliding all over the place. That's really
indeed.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. I never knew you were at E3 as Mr. Handy. That's a thing I know now. That's so funny.
Is there footage of it?
There probably is, and the Mr. Handy itself was really cool. It was a fully animatronic thing with, you know, lights and arms moving and stuff like that, and that was really neat. I suspect there's something online from that, but of course you can't see me the person because I'm
right
hidden behind the wall in back of Mr. Handy.
That's amazing though. When I play Fallout, I never take Codsworth anywhere because I'm just like, you know what, he's had enough like torture in his life of being alone for 200 years. You stay home, I'll go fight stuff, it's fine. You know, so it's so funny because, you know, I think about him sometimes and then I think about the other Mr. Handys and I'm like, they're all voiced by the same person. It's so weird. I don't know, that's why voice acting is so crazy to me, because you can basically be a chameleon and voice whoever. It's really wild.
Yeah, that's one of the fun things about it too. And I think one of the reasons why I had some initial success and people continued to, you know, contact me about other work too, was a certain versatility that allowed me to. It's great when you have a voice actor who you can hire for a session and get, you know, three or four characters out of them in one session.
You get a bang for your buck.
Yep.
One of the things that I admire about the entertainment community is that oftentimes people with disabilities or differences or social, you know, just social or intellectual differences, they latch on to these characters. Do you have any stories of, you know, fan encounters when they've met you or told you how your work has impacted them?
I don't get that much opportunity, Bob, to interact with people in person. I've done a few conventions over the years, and it's been nice when people have come up and you know, told me how much they like the games. But those situations are generally so, you know, there isn't a lot of time for in-depth conversations.
Yeah.
But I have been amazed by some of the emails that I've received over the years, and people just telling me how the work that I've done or the games that I've been involved in have, and I think the thing that I've heard more often than anything else is that just it helped them get through a particularly dark time in their lives when they were depressed or just feeling emotionally bereft for some reason. And the games became something that they could, a world that they could enter into that felt safe and, it's an odd word to use, welcoming, for an environment that's often so hostile. But But there is a certain safety in the environment that is virtual as opposed to real, and it's been extremely gratifying to me to know that that work has been of that has been helpful for people in that way. You know, I think when you're actually doing the work, you're so focused on trying to get it right and doing a good job of it that you don't necessarily envision what it's going to do on the other side, how it's going to affect people, and to find that it has a positive effect, or has had a positive effect, and has helped people, makes it all so much more worthwhile to me.
And I think you had a kill brilliantly, because you created, as hostile as the game environment is, you really do create a safe space, because you take them away from whatever they're going through, you know, and it's really, right. Really nice.
Yeah, I can personally attest to that. I had a friend who was actually the one who introduced me to Fallout, because I saw a clip of him playing it on Facebook, and I was like, what game is this? And he's like, oh, it's Fallout 4. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to pick that up. That looks cool. So I was playing it for a number of years, and then he started having medical issues, and eventually he passed away. And so Fallout, you know, whenever I play it, it's kind of my last connection that I have to him. And I think about him sometimes, and I'm like, you know, oh, he would love this. You know, he'd get a kick out of this. He'd really like that I'm doing this interview. He'd be thrilled for me. But he, you know, that's kind of how I remember him now. I kind of memorialize him by playing Fallout almost. It's interesting. So I have had personal experience in that regard as well.
Yeah.
What you're saying, Jane, about doing this interview and having this conversation is what I'm trying to do here is create a safe space for all of us to express our feelings and our creative endeavors in a nice, comforting, safe space. And I hope that I've achieved that.
Yeah.
I think you have. I mean, both, you know, as your friend, as a co-host, and as a listener, I think you have quite the little, you know, nice environment going. It's very like, it's very casual, you know. It's not like a super formal interview where you're like, oh, am I going to ask this question right? Or am I going to say the right thing? It's just very like, you know, you're having a conversation. That's what I really like, both as a listener and as somebody who's hosting this with you. It's nice to just hear people talk to each other, like people, you know?
Yeah. I love, the interview format in general, but the interviews that I particularly enjoy listening to, and I think, you know, Terry Gross is a master of this.
Oh my, yes.
Are the ones that do sound like a conversation, that allow room for tangents to go off in and explore some aspect of the person's life or work that has that you might not otherwise get to.
Yeah, my goal with this was to not just talk about your career, and really know the person behind the work, because we're sharing, we're connecting.
Mm-hmm.
We have this time together now, so let's use it wisely, you know?
Yep. Yeah. Do you both happen to know of a BBC radio program called Desert Island Discs?
Oh, yes.
I haven't heard of that, but that sounds interesting. What's that about?
Well, it's a program that's been running since the late 1940s. It's I think the longest running radio show in the world. And the format of it is there is a host who has a different guest every week, and the guest can be from any field of endeavor that you can possibly imagine, from entertainers to sports figures to politicians to scientists. And sometimes I'll tune into a program and I'll see who the guest is that week, And I'll go, oh, that's somebody I'm not very interested in hearing about, or a subject I'm not really all that interested in, but I'll start listening and I'll just be so drawn in by the conversation and this shared humanity that gets revealed. The format of the interview is that the guest is being cast away on a desert island and they have to choose 8 songs that they would want to have. Or, I mean, it started out in the 40s when there was only one song on a side of a 78. So the discs part of it was, you know, you would just take a single song or a single musical piece. But that format has remained the same ever since. So it's choosing 8 musical selections as well as 1 luxury item and 1 book. And they use that format to talk about significant moments in the artist's life. But it's really interesting how the musical selections in particular bring up all kinds of emotions and history and memories. And I'm always fascinated by hearing what moves people in music, because it's a big part of my life. And also just they've had some great hosts over the years, and it's very much like Terry Gross in that there are these opportunities that are presented for revelations that you just don't get in a normal kind of interview program.
And that is the brilliance of like creative people, and especially people in the podcast or radio industry, that you can take an idea like that and turn it into its own thing. And it inspires people to use their mind and think of something even better and kind of dig deeper.
Yeah. Yep.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, I do. I think you'll find the great thing about the program now is that they've archived so much of the previous programs. So you can go back now and, you know, you can, if there's a significant figure in the from the late 20th century or the beginning of the 21st century, chances are they've been on Desert Island Disc, particularly if they're from the UK. So anyone you can think of, you'll probably be able to find their Castaway episode.
That's really neat. I don't know how I could pick one book if I was on there though, because I have both a bachelor's and I'm about to get a master's in creative writing. So if somebody asked me to pick one book, I'd look at them and I'd be like, I literally cannot do that. So that'd be hard. But
that would be the challenge for me too, Jane. I don't know, and it changes all the time for me too. So if you had to pick your top 5 authors, who would they be?
Oh God. So I want to start. Well, I want to say Stephen King, because like I really like horror, so that's obvious. I don't know if you know who Jodi Picoult is, but she writes commercial fiction. Yep. I like her as well. Kristen Hannah, again, commercial fiction. I don't know.
And if she has a new book coming out this month.
Yes, she does. I don't know if you've ever heard of a book called Ordinary People. That's probably my favorite book ever. So I would pick Judith Guest as well. And then I guess for like a fun author, Janet Ivanovich, she writes like the Stephanie Plum books, which are hilarious. So yeah, I definitely have like some favorite authors, but if somebody was like, you know, pick one book, I'd be like, do I pick Ordinary People? Do I pick something else? I don't know. So yeah, that would be really difficult.
My book would probably be like Tuesdays with Maury, because that book encompasses so many life lessons that we all need to.
That's such a good book. I read that a while ago and I really liked it. I'm glad you like that book. It's a good one.
Good choice. Yeah.
So, yeah. So on that note, Stephen, to wrap this up, not to put you on the spot, but here I am putting you on the spot. do you have any questions for us to kind of turn the table? What do you want to know? I mean, it's your first time meeting us, but is there anything that you're interested to know or hear about?
Yeah. What gets you out of bed in the day?
I don't, you know, honestly, a lot of what gets me out of bed these days is, you know, I have motivation to like work on my writing projects that I'm working on. And that's kind of what motivates me every day. I think, you know, one day I'm going to publish this book and, you know, maybe it'll go somewhere, or I'll write a script and that'll go somewhere. So a lot of it is like thinking of the future and like things I could theoretically achieve as a creative person. That's kind of what keeps me going. Bob, I don't know about you, but what keeps you going?
It's interesting because in our predicament, people in our predicament could be so kind of, you know, sad about their lives and, oh, I have these physical limitations. But I honestly feel like if I wasn't disabled, I wouldn't have all this time to create as much as I do now, because I was so limited physically that I had to go to something else to be creative and have a fulfilling life, you know?
Uh-huh. That's good answers, both of you.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with that, actually. I think a lot of what, and I'm just hitting on this now, but I think a lot of what has driven my desire to, you know, be a writer over the years is just that thought of like, you know, I can't do a lot physically, but, you know, maybe I can create something or write about something. Like I had the opportunity to write a while back, a journalistic piece about my experiences trying to play video games with cerebral palsy. And it kind of started a good discussion, you know, in the comments, which is unusual because usually people are really mean on the internet, you know, but a lot of people are very nice and like asking me questions and stuff. And it was really cool. So, you know, things like that, that's kind of what I think is like, you know, I can't do a lot physically, but mentally I'm pretty with it a lot of the time. And I'm like, oh, I want to say this, so I'll use this medium and do this thing. And so that's my big motivation in life, is like just putting something out there and just making something, not for the sake of like being known necessarily, but just for the sake of creating something. And I think probably that's something that you both can relate to as well.
For sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Steven, it's been such a joy talking to you. And whenever you have a new project or anything, feel free to reach out and we'd love to have you back.
Okay. I would love to do it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a real joy talking to you today.
My pleasure.
And where can people find you on the internet? Where can people keep in touch?
Oh, God, I have a website that I never keep up with.
So basically what you're saying is we're lucky that we got in touch with you.
Pretty much so, yeah. Yeah, the website is StephenRussellVoice.com. You'll find a lot of information there from 5 years ago. And you know, I have a couple of projects I'm working on right now, one of which is a really interesting show called Fog Town that's I'm pretty excited about. It's
I saw the teaser and the video. That's so cool.
Yeah, yeah, those guys are I think they're onto something there. It's very silly, but very fun.
Yeah. Speaking of shows, not to throw one more question at you, but I heard there's going to be a Fallout TV show. Did they cast you in that, or are you not a part of that?
If they have, I don't know about it yet. So
okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see, because I'm wondering, you know, are they going to have a Mr. Handy, or are they going to bring you on? But I don't know. You know, I don't know what all that's going to be like. It's going to be really cool, I'm sure. But
yeah, I'm sure it will too.
Thank you so much for this.
Yeah, thank you. It was really fun.
Anytime.
Thanks for hanging out with us at the DJ Bob Show. If you liked this episode, drop us a line at djbobrunkel@gmail.com. That's djbobrunkel@gmail.com. Let us know what you liked most about this episode and what other guests we should have on the DJ Bob Show. Thanks so much again for hanging out with us. This is Nate Beagle, your humble announcer.